Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase.
There's a lot to say when buying a new home or car, but only one thing to say that can help you protect them. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. And just like that, a State Farm agent will be there to help you choose the coverage you need, no matter where you are in life. When you need coverage options, your State Farm agent is there to help, on the phone or in person. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Welcome to Nerdist Podcast number 541. Yes, I am sick. So I'm not going to talk a whole lot because I sound not good. I'm sure it's not fun to listen to. And I apologize. Yes, I'm sorry for getting sick. I will take that on. I apologize that I got sick. Just so you know, we added a second Nerdist Podcast Live at San Diego Comic-Con. The first show was at 10:30. We added a 7:30 show because the first one is sold out. So please sell out the second one. Go to the internet, I guess. You know, I should have been prepared with the URL. Just San Diego Comic-Con 2014 Nerdist Podcast Live, and then Google it, and then get the ticket link. I apologize. It's because I'm sick. I have sick brain. This episode is Gary Cole. Gary Cole has been in a million and a half things. He is a phenomenal actor. Just a cool dude. He kind of reminded me of Cranston a lot. We had a great chat. He's in a movie called Tammy, which is out in theaters on July 2nd. That's the movie with Melissa McCarthy in it. And, you know, Gary, you probably know from the Brady Bunch movie or from Office Space or, you know, as I said, any of the other million and a half things that he's done. And here he is right now on the Nerdist Podcast number 541. It's Gary Cole. I'm sick.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Gary, we should start.
I have not now, nor ever have been, a member. Never mind.
Are you a member? Wait, you are a member of the Communist Party.
A member of PETA. No.
Wait, what? That's not what this trial's about. But I'm glad we know. I'm glad we know. I have a story that involves me approaching you.
Uh-oh.
That I'm sure you will not remember, and I'm glad because in the back of my head, I've always chalked it up as one of my celebrity fails on my part, which is I was doing a voiceover thing and I ran into you at it's in North Hollywood somewhere on
Magnolia. Voiceover.
Yeah, it was a voiceover thing.
Okay, all right.
And I came up to you because the previous week, our my friend Lee Allen Baker was doing a show with you for
sure.
HBO.
Right.
And she said I did a love scene with Gary Cole. And Rob, my friend Rob, really quickly said, man, as in Gary Coleman. And I related this story to you, and you were like, yeah. And before I finished, you go, yeah, because our names are similar.
We compete for all the same parts,
and
we did.
What it reminded me is that don't approach someone with a funny story about their name because it's their name and they fucking know it already. They know it already. They've heard it a million times and you're not the first. That is what I was reminded by. I'm like, I can't believe I've been in the business this
long. That was my name the first like 8 months I was in Hollywood. Every casting office had opened. I'd like to introduce you to Gary Coleman. I mean, I'm sorry, Gary Cole.
Different guy.
Yeah.
Totally.
When I got to town in like 80, I guess what? 83, 84 was the first work I did here. He was like huge.
Yes. Yeah. Couldn't get any bigger.
Different Strokes was at the peak of its.
There was, you know, it was a train that was never slowing
right.
down.
He was the king of NBC, Gary Coleman. So.
And I mean, a spinoff.
Yeah.
Facts alive.
Yeah, yeah.
Money was flowing.
Yeah.
And
so
then
it was I had to quickly correct everyone about that. we were always confused.
That was probably always although I got to say, probably a good icebreaker in an audition room.
Yes.
You're like, I know you thought, but I'm
yeah,
not,
it did loosen up the room a little bit. Yeah, people
started
chuckling.
You don't want me to read for this small African American child part? Or
yeah, what are you saying?
I mean, prepared.
You're really putting limitations on this role.
I mean, I'm an actor.
I can be versatile.
So 83 is when you got to Los Angeles.
I did the first, 84 actually. It was the Summer Olympics. First job I had. I had done one network TV movie back in the heyday of network TV movies. Mm-hmm. And that was the year before. But then the first time I worked here was in, was the summer that the Olympics were here in Los Angeles in 1984. Yeah.
It was an electric time.
Oh, it was.
Here.
It was.
We still have the Coliseum.
Oh, way back then. Yes.
What was let's see, I'd been to Los Angeles in 1984, I think, at some point, but what was the climate of the entertainment business in 1984?
Well, it was still pretty, I mean, there were virtually no cable television. I think there was this upstart, you know, channel that everyone laughed at called Fox. Mm-hmm. I don't even know if that was around. It was basically, you know, it was three network channels. That was it. 80% of the movie business was shot in town. And that's very different today.
It's not the same anymore.
You know, you'd be hard pressed. I've worked quite a bit in the last couple of years, and I'm real grateful for that. None of it has been in Los Angeles, though. So.
It's very rare. It's expensive to shoot here.
Yeah. Yeah. It's not friendly. You know,
you probably spent a lot of time in Vancouver.
I've done the Couve. I've done Toronto. I've done Shreveport. I've done Savannah, Georgia. I've done Austin, Texas.
People go to Prague sometimes.
Sure. I was just in Bulgaria. To shoot a movie about people in Manhattan stuck in an elevator. That's why you go to Bulgaria, because they got great elevators in Bulgaria.
Yeah, but you're going to get stuck in one, and you might as well shoot a movie the other way there.
What the hell?
What was your ultimate plan when you did you come out to Los Angeles to be a performer, or was there another reason?
I've never had much of a plan about anything. Maybe that's partly my downfall, but no, I came from Chicago. I was doing a lot of theater in Chicago, and I wound up out here in 84 just almost as a fluke. It was just, it was a mini series that was very close to shooting, and they were looking for this role. It was called Fatal Vision. It was about a guy named Jeff McDonald, who was finally convicted of murdering his family. He was a Green Beret doctor, and all. It was a true story. And they hadn't cast this role, but the movie was set to go. So I basically was still in Chicago, and the casting director knew, you know, one of those stories, a friend of a friend of a friend, flew out here, got the part, and, you know, then just started to hop back and forth for the next few years from Chicago to here.
Were you doing any type of comedy or theater in Chicago?
I had done kind of 50-50 each on stage. I had done comedy and I had done, you know, dramas and all that. But when I got here, I virtually kind of fell into the network drama, and or when I got here, the bread and butter of network television was these disease of the week or women in jeopardy movies.
Yep.
They were all over the schedule. They were like 40% of the broadcast schedule. So that's, I did a lot of that.
What types of roles were you getting? Were you getting the role of
anybody that, you know, somebody that did something horrible to a woman, somebody who was with a woman who had something horrible done to her, mm-hmm. dying people, dying children, dying this, dying that, this disease, that disease. Some were okay. Some were decently done. Some were the kindest thing I would say is were disposable.
Do you remember one where you went, you know, I know it's important to work, but this is really bad. This is the worst.
Well, early on, no, because I was like, I couldn't believe the financial return compared to where I had come from.
Sure.
So I wasn't questioning too much. You know, I don't know that any great deal of nobility any ever creeped into my soul, period. There were a few that I just knew were not so much that I knew that the material itself was whatever, questionable, but that the job I was doing necessarily was just, I wasn't, it was early. I was learning a lot. And sometimes after you work a while, you figure out how to make things work that may be questionable.
Mm-hmm.
And but there were times early in my career I didn't know how to do that. So, so they just came off as questionable and bad and, you know, kind of wincing, you know, when you watch them. So
yeah, but you got to go through that stuff because
sure.
You don't, you can't appreciate the good stuff unless you've had the bad
stuff.
No, I
do, especially in front of a camera. I think you learn sometimes more by doing something and doing it horribly,
mm-hmm.
and looking at it later and go, oh boy, I'm not going to do that again.
Well, you have, I mean, look.
Or I'm going to learn not what to not do.
If you watch yourself from, you know, 25 years ago and you go, that guy was good, you probably have not grown a lot as a performer.
Yeah. No,
it's,
I agree,
it's very
with
important.
That. You know, I was lucky a few times early and also that a lot of that had to do with good material and good directors.
Yeah.
But then there's sometimes you watch and you go, ooh. It's painful, really painful.
What was the thing for you that you started to feel like everything aligning and like, oh, this kind of clicked. What was that?
Well, the first thing I did, I was very, very lucky. It was very good material, and I was with, like, you know, kind of iconic actors. I was working with Carl Malden and Eva Marie Saint and Andy Griffith. That was the first time I showed up here and had a job. So that was like, you know, it was unbelievable to me. And the material was good. Director was good. And so that worked well. And then later on, I did a series about four years later called Midnight Caller,
mm-hmm.
Which had a really good writing staff and, for the most part, really strong writing. And the fact of that was a great learning environment when you're doing a series and you're playing a character. And I virtually worked every day all day, so it was just kind of, not only the material was good, but the amount of work I had to do on a daily basis kind of forced you into, you know, figuring out how to be in front of a camera and survive that way and you know it, little things like just being relaxed and you know, not forcing things. And so over a period of time I just got more and more confident. That was pretty key for me, I think, early on.
But when I think of you as a performer too, I think of someone who makes really great choices that you go, oh fuck, that's exactly how that character should be, like that's that guy. So did you focus a lot on character work, or was it just like, you know, and just sort of do whatever?
Well, choices is, that's the secret to anything in playing a character. It's to make, first of all, is to make choices, period, good or bad. But what's worse than bad choices is somebody playing a character and it looks like they've made no choice. And it's just kind of vanilla and
right.
Bland. You know, I'd rather see I'd rather see a performance that makes me angry than one that makes me bored.
Right.
You know what I mean? Or just non, or just like somebody that's invisible. I, you know, I'd rather go, I can't believe he's doing that, you know, but it's some kind of committed choice. And that's what I think the key is to, you know, go through the script and in the story, and how is this character going to serve the story best? And then you base your choices make on that. But it's all about that. It's all about, you know, crossing the T and dotting the I, and how it fits in with the rest of everybody else, and also the story itself.
Yeah, and so I have to ask for when Brady Bunch comes along, how does that? I mean, obviously, the approach that they took to that, which is, in my mind, the only way they could have approached
yes,
that project.
Correct.
The only way they
correct.
Could have done that.
Right.
So did you have a sense of that going in? You knew.
I knew, and as soon as... And I had known Betty Thomas. I had worked with Betty Thomas before. She had directed me once before, and I just knew her from mutual friends. That script had been I had heard about that script for years. There was rumors about, oh, we're going to do a Brady Bunch movie. And the first, you know, question a lot of people would ask was, and why?
Right.
Why would that be? But obviously they wanted a blueprint of all those other actors. They wanted people to remember all those quirks of all of those specific people: Robert Reed, Florence Henderson, Eve Plum, all of them. And that's what Betty set out to do. And it was also shot the same way. You know, you had that, anytime you were in the house, you had this kind of, you know, washed out white bland, flat look, you know, with the AstroTurf lawn and all of that stuff. And then when you went outside, it was all different. And it was like a monster movie that they were, you know, they were left in the 70s and everybody else had moved ahead, and everybody who saw them were almost frightened by them because they were so weird. So yeah, that was the best idea, to just do it and try to redo them and like have everybody regard them as normal. All the other people would have been a big mistake. I don't think it would have been funny, and I don't know that it would have been particularly watchable on any level. So she made a good choice. Yeah.
So what was your approach to Mike? Like what was his?
I started to watch multiple episodes, which was, you know, which was a task unto itself. But I started to notice that his big thing was they always left him with the moral of the story kind
right.
of thing. You know, Greg, if you do A, then B will happen.
Well,
know?
It was the 60s and he was the dad.
Right, exactly. He was the sitcom dad and he had the answer to
every question.
Every dilemma. But he also had... I started to notice this kind of, you would think it was, well, it's not very distinct delivery, but he had some kind of, he could put five syllables in a word that had one somehow. I mean, he was a Greg, you know. And so I tried to get something going with that. And then as the script started to roll in and they kept giving him more of these moral of the story things that made absolutely no sense whatsoever. The goal was just probably to make him as vacant and clueless as possible, and yet on the outside seem totally confident.
Just it's all platitudes.
But what
and
he's
no
saying
substance.
Is absolutely, you know, just absurd gibberish. But he's very confident in it. Yeah.
And did you ever meet Robert Reed? Was he alive
no.
when the movie came out?
No. He had passed away probably well before the movie.
I can't remember when I just
we thought. Did. Sherwood Schwartz was a presence though on the set. He came,
must have been 100 years old.
He was at the time, I think, I'm not sure he was in his 90s yet. I think he was like 90 or 91. He was a riot. He would come and he would tell stories about them all, and he was he really enjoyed himself, and it was great to have him there because we could just, you know, we could ask him about stuff. And we actually shot the first movie on the same stage where they shot at Paramount. So it was like there were ghosts in there.
It is kind of funny that show was sort of the beginning of, people in this business get real fucked up, and sometimes it can happen publicly. Like it really was sort of the start of that era of the public starting to see,
yeah.
like, oh, TV people, they're not, some of them are not normal.
No, it was starting to be, you had the beginning of some media coverage, media entertainment, early 70s. I think it went on in 69. And all of those kids, and they were kids when they started, they really, you know, they all grew up in front of the camera, which is not an easy thing, I'm sure, to do. They were all like at least, I think, Barry and Maureen were probably, I don't know, maybe 14 when they started. Everybody
and
else
what
was
a
young.
Crazy time to have that kind of a show when essentially the world is like flipped on its head.
Right.
And culturally,
well,
insane shit is happening.
Sure. And you look, I mean, you look at television in, you know, from like, just starting in like 68 or something, you know, the country is on fire, literally. And we're watching I Dream of Jeannie.
Yep.
And, you know, My Favorite Martian. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, total fantasy, you know, just escapism.
Complete escapism. But then also, you know, I'm sure... kind of driving, I mean, that next wave of television that came after it was, I'm assuming, just a complete reaction to that. No, people have more shades to their personalities, and that's that whole Norman Lear era
sure.
of television.
Right.
Where it's like, no.
Well, you could say one thing about the Brady Bunch, but I don't know that we'd seen a family, you know, for lack of a better word, mixed family.
You know,
they were from, you know, he had his brood, she had hers.
Yeah, I guess.
I don't even remember what the situation was with their other spouses. I don't think they mentioned the word. I don't think it was divorce. I don't know what.
Oh, yeah, I don't.
Were they both widowers? I guess maybe they were, probably.
I guess
because in 1969 they were going, yeah, let's hook up. I just divorced my wife and now it's time to get married.
Just get these three really annoying kids.
Yeah.
The husband drinks and he fucking won't shut up about whatever it is that he's going on about.
I doubt it was that, but.
Yeah, I guess that really
That was a new one, though.
That really was a new one. Actually, in a way, it was sort of culturally forward-thinking because it dealt with the idea of a broken family coming together and forming a new family.
Yeah, but I guess they didn't have to carry the stigma of broken. They could just say, they were grieving families.
They were. Internally, they were broken, right. But on the outside, everything was groovy. Yeah, and I got and
it was a dark, dark show.
Very dark.
It,
if you look just under the surface.
Yes.
Which is ultimately the subtext of the movie, which is like this was dark.
Which is what you want to spend your time doing, probing underneath the depths of the Brady Bunch.
Are you a guy that just like, I just like to work and in whatever it is, I'm just like, just give it to me and I like work? Or do you seek out specific types of roles?
I mean, at this point, no. I mean, I'm really just kind of reacting to what's real or what's, an opportunity for me. I think I've, over the years you try to develop some kind of, bullshit meter in terms of what you think you can do well and what you think is going to, fall on its face.
Yeah.
No matter what you do. So you just kind of have to weigh that. I've been real fortunate, and especially in the last few years, is to find myself winding up not only with really good material, but really good people working with. And that's, as kind of a journeyman act, that's all you can hope for. That's the best you can hope for.
So do you believe that it's just a never-ending process and everything's an experience? Or do you feel like you have stuff figured out, or does it seem like...
No. You have a body of work to draw from, and you have experiences to draw from that help you when you're working. But you continually, I think, if you pay attention, that's the key, is paying attention and having the energy to pay attention when you are working. You can really learn a lot. I'm in a situation now that on this show, Veep, with Julia Louis-Dreyfus, which is done totally differently than most television I've ever done. I mean, it's every script we get, we have a table read, then they throw the script away, and we get up and we just kind of move through every scene without the script and improvise it and start to, tweak it, and it morphs into a bunch of different forms. Then the writers go away. They either take some of that, don't mix it up, and we come back and they've got another script again. We do the same thing over again.
Oh my God. So it's just an evolving collaboration, and even when
we're shooting, that process on a smaller level is taking place, and we're just, even if a scene isn't working, or even if it is working, but they want something else out of it, then it will, on the set, on the day, it will be manipulated and turned around as we go, which is true in some places, but most of the time, it's like once something hits the paper and those are the words in a one-hour drama or even a comedy, that's it. You make those work hell or high water, and that's not the situation here. And she's I just think she's amazing, but she's in a zone right now where she's just like...
I think she's been in a zone for like the last 30 years.
Yeah.
I mean, it's fucking crazy, She...
No, her level of... the combination of her ability and her work ethic, it's lethal. I mean,
who gets three hit critically acclaimed shows, like one right after the other? That's when you really start to... go like, oh yeah, it wasn't a fluke.
No, it was her. She is not a fluke whatsoever. She's got the goods. Absolutely.
And so do you what's your work ethic in terms of like, do you leave it at the, can you leave it at the studio, or do you go home and pour over it, or is it how?
No, I rarely pour over anything. When I hear rap for the day, there's not a lot of pouring.
Okay, later. It can be like a job.
Yeah, I've
you.
Never I've well yeah I've never been kind of it never seems to me that it's some kind of lingering thing to me. I think that when you're not in the act of working, it's just it's on hold until you start it again.
Yeah,
you know, but that's not true for everybody. That I'm just saying that that's the way, you know, that's the way it feels to me.
How many times a week do people shout Office Space quotes at you? is it 1,000 times a week? Or is it 10,
depends where I am.
A week?
Depends where, if I'm in a contained space. in an airport, I'll hear a lot more because, you know, you're there and you're not going anywhere. You're not in motion until you get on the plane.
Right.
It's pretty amazing that movie has kind of lasted this long, because that right now that's like a, that's what is it, 15 years?
I think like 15, yeah.
16 years, yeah.
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 And so was that, what was that process like? Was Mike Judge like, here's the script, or was he said, you know, do you say go build this character or let's play with it or?
No, it was very specific, especially, well, Office Space is actually based on two little short animations that he did, both of which only had my character and Milton.
I remember them from the Spike Steven, and Mike festivals. Right. Yeah.
In one, there's actually a smaller character of a delivery guy with a hand truck that a Mike also voices.
Yeah.
And he did all the voices for both characters. So my, when I went in to meet for it, he had sent out these animations. So I just went in and, you know, and I looked at it and I you know, I decided right there. So I can't do it better than this, so I'll do this. I'll just, you know, do an imitation of this. I'm assuming that's what they want to have happen.
And, yeah.
And I was correct in my assumption. So, yeah, I just based it on what he did. And so the rest of the movie, he wrote around those two characters. So that's how the movie came out.
It sounds to me, without really knowing you at all, but just it kind of sounds to me like you have probably the healthiest attitude about the entertainment business, which is like, you know, I go to work, I enjoy my work, I work hard, and then I don't think about it when I leave. Because you can't, just like with Office Space, you can't know that is going to become a movie that has permeated pop culture for 15 years. You don't know what's going to be a hit or what people are never going to see.
No, but what you can have, what you can know, and I don't know if you can know it, but you can have an instinct about, and everyone in that movie did, they all knew that it was good. They all knew it was something that they would watch and that made them laugh. All of the actors in the movie. We were all talking about how, you know, how great Mike was and how specific the characters were. But you never know. You never know if a movie's going to break through or have an impact or push people's buttons. You're not going to know any of that until it does or doesn't. So it was, it was a, you know, but it was certainly a pleasant surprise that it hung around as long as it did.
Was there ever talk of like, let's do more of these?
There was, I'm sure, from the studio after, not initially, because it didn't really do well at all. It got off the hook only because it didn't cost a lot to make, so it didn't really lose money, but it didn't make any money initially. And then it started to have this, you know, kind of life afterwards. That was about the time also when I think the business of DVDs and you know, its sale to pay television and stuff, that was peaking, and then it was able to kind of snowball from there. I mean, who would have thought there was, not that there's been a great, I don't know what the take on the merchandise from this movie is, but there is the fact that there is merchandise, period.
Yeah.
About a movie about guys walking around in an office, you know, and people selling staplers off its shelf because, you know, from a movie, that's, you know, nobody would have thought that. But it was hard, yeah. I mean, it was hard to know at the time.
What's your favorite part of the process? Is it the actual? Because the thing that you do, the thing that is your profession, you actually do the least, which is actually your on-camera acting. Like that, I feel like you spend the least time doing the thing that you actually are the most trained to do.
Probably true.
So what is your?
That's why it's a bizarre business.
It's really fucking weird.
You're waiting. you're waiting to be in a process. It a lot of it is, yeah, it's that's kind of where some of the I guess insanity comes from, if you want to call it that. But I don't know. I mean, it's just, you know, it's just being, I think, open to when you are working, grateful for when you are, and realizing that it, you know, that when you are working, it's not a given. You know, that's what I realized pretty early. You know, I had success early. I was young, and I worked a lot. But there still were times when all of a sudden it just would stop, you know, and it would just like, you're not, you know, there is no next thing, you know, and you don't know what the next thing is going to be. And there's periods of time that, you know, that would linger. And so that's when it gets, you know, a little dicey about what's, you know, what's going on. But that's true with anybody who's in any kind of freelance business, anybody that's, you know, making stuff for a living that they're selling. I mean, you know, they're going to have up and down time. So it's just kind of.
Yeah, but still, it's like, I mean, and it's only recently started to change a little bit because people can, ultimately, you can go make something and put it on the internet.
Sure.
Which is, you right. know, which can work or it cannot work. But I feel like in other businesses, it, you know, it's not necessarily like, I'm waiting for someone to tell me that I'm good enough to be in this thing, and I don't know when that's going to be, because it's just...
Right, well, somebody put it in a good way to me once, is they got, I'm sick of waiting for permission to work, which is, yeah. you know, but that's, you know, that's one way. There's a lot of people, and, you know, that take that into their own hands, you know, and it's, I think it's even truer now than it used to be, even though there was, you know, that Mavericks that did that, that, you know, actors that showed up here and just started to create their own material. But I think now, because of all of the, you know, all of the resources and, you know, technology, and an example is, with Seth Rogen and his partner, Evan Goldberg, who wrote Pineapple Express and a million other movies, and, you know, are got their permanent office at Sony Pictures, and they're just, you know, writing one movie after the other. You know, and he was like, when he did Pineapple Express, I don't know, he was 20, I don't know what he was, 25, 26 years old. You know, I was still roaming around bars in Chicago when I was 25 and 26. And when he was in eighth grade, he and Evan Goldberg were writing movies, shooting them on their little digital phones or whatever, and editing them at home. You know, and when I was in eighth grade, I was throwing cherry bombs into the creek and watching them blow up. So, I mean, it's a different, you know, life experience there. So when they hit town, they had a trunk load of material already that they were ready to, you know, try to, you know, put in the marketplace. And they broke through. Now, for every story like that, there's 100 other ones that just, you know, never get in an office door. But they, you know, he didn't do it. He started on a TV show, Freaks and Geeks. But beyond that, he was able to generate his own career.
Yeah.
You know, and not wait for permission, except for, I mean, it's a little different. He had to wait for permission for somebody to green light his material.
Right.
But once that happened, then he kind of, you know, wrote his own ticket.
So what do you like to do in the off time? Do you do nothing, or do you?
Well, in the meantime, you know, life happened. You know, I had a family. I had a daughter that, you know, is 21 years old now. So that was a great deal of time devoted to, you know, her, you know, her life and, you know, her needs and all of that. And that still takes place, even though she's 21. That doesn't end. It changes and morphs into something else. But, you know, and I've been in the last few years, I've been pretty busy. So, you know, with the mix of that pretty much, you know, pretty much eats it all up.
Does it basically just go from thing to thing to thing? Like you're working on Veep, and then whether you're on Friday, on Monday, you're doing something else.
This last couple of years, that has been true. I've been on Veep. Veep is about 5 months a year. I was at the same time was also doing, and still am here and there, a recurring role on The Good Wife. Last year I had a little thing on Suits for another few months. This summer I've been doing, I've done already 5 or 6 independent films, all in different, you know, one's in Austin, and one's going to be here, one's going to be in Cleveland. So it actually has, you know, I've had time in between each, but not a lot, you know, just weeks at a time. So I've been, you know, been able to keep busy so far.
How do you view success? Would you say, like, I made it, I am successful because I am working all the time? Or do you go, oh, I really want to kind of do this thing before I feel like, aha? Or do you not even think about that stuff?
Yeah, I mean, that's a loaded word, I think, especially in this business.
Because you don't know if it means financial or if it means, like, number of eyeballs.
It can mean all of that, you know. But it you know, I just base... I just go with reality. You know, I'm on a, I'm in a enviable position. For a lot of actors, I'm on a show that people seem to give a shit about. Mm-hmm. That is really good, and has, you know, has some kind of acclaim that way, and that is lasting, which is even, you know, the most important thing. So that to me is, you know, for where I am sitting in my career, that that's, I would define that as somewhat, you know, a success. Sure.
Yeah. Why do you think that, it's just such a weird business, because it plays upon a lot of people's insecurities just because of the amount of rejection or just the amount of judgment or the amount of, but it also seems to attract people that are predisposed to be really scared and insecure and need validation. And like, it really seems like just the worst mix of two things.
Well, I think, I don't know. I think there's a lot of, if you look at the need, the most important thing to me is if, before someone seeks out some kind of survival in the business, I would say talent, sure, very helpful. Mm-hmm. But if there is no desire to need to perform, you know, for whatever reason, some intangible reason, you must perform. You see this story and you've got to be a part of it to tell it. If that isn't kind of really out front, then it's I don't know. It's not the foundation is can be shaky. Now people can, you know, they can be incredibly talented and have success and really don't like doing it at all.
Right.
Like a lot of people don't like their jobs, but they make a great deal of money at it, and then that, you know, that all happens. But I think over the long term, anybody that's going to have longevity in the business embraces that kind of insanity, if you will, of the, you know, the rejection of it, the kind of you know, seemingly unfairness of it, but there is no what's fair. There's nothing fair, and that's true with everything.
Right.
You know? I think that you know, as long as you if that's the need up front, is the need to this survival to perform, then all the business end of it, you call it show business. If you got the show, if that's really what you got at your core, then, you know, you tolerate the business end of it and you survive the business. That stuff will work out of it. So I remember talking to kids at a like Q&A thing, and they were asking about, you know, well, what's it, you know, the public eye and this and that, and, you know, and I'm saying that's or where do you get your pictures, or who is it about who you know and all of this, and I said, that'll work itself out if you really want to do this. If there's no plan B, if this is plan A and there is no plan B, which I believe for a lot of people is the only way to survive it, mm-hmm. then that's the most important thing. All that other stuff is just, you know, that's stuff. That'll work itself out.
It's almost counterintuitive. I feel like Bryan Cranston said the exact same thing. He said there was no plan B. I just knew if I had to live in an apartment with four other guys that this was going to be the thing I was going to do.
It gives you clarity. Let's put it that way.
Yeah.
You know, if you say, I'm in, and that's what I remember actually saying the words when I was 20 years old in college, and I had no, you know, I was in Bloomington, Illinois. I had not been anywhere near anything that resembled the business or whatever. I was in college. But I had done, you know, a fair amount of work for my age in terms of being on stage. Not that any of it was any good, but I had, you know, I had been in that environment. I liked it. I needed to be there. And I just kind of in my brain said, you know what? I'm 20 years old, but I'm in. I'm in for the duration. And it doesn't matter. I'm not going anywhere else. Don't want to, you know. And everything I did led to that. Sure, I had to get jobs and all that stuff, but it was always, in my mind, knew it was temporary. I didn't embark on any kind of other career path, mainly because I certainly had no qualifications in any other career path.
It's kind of interesting that it's almost, some people would say, well, it's risky not to have a plan B, but I guess another point of view is that it is risky to give yourself backup plans, because then if the second things aren't going well, you're like, bail.
Well, but that I think that's the moment of clarity that people have. And I think, you know, I've known people that I knew were talented, really talented, That's how they put their 1 foot in the pool, and they just said, yeah, this is, I kind of enjoy this, but ooh, I don't know. It just looks, you know, I have visions of a futon in a closet, and I don't want to.
Those sharks at the end of that pool? Those look like sharks.
And they, you know, they went elsewhere, and that's cool. But I think you're right. I think on some level it's helpful to just say, that's it. I'm putting my head down. I'm going through this fence, and you know, I'm not looking back.
What is it that you see? You know, when, you know, especially if you're, because you're pretty set with Veep, but when these, you said you did a bunch of independent films. So when these independent films come in, what is it that you look for? Like, what is it that pops about something for you that makes you feel like I'm going to go?
Well, you always look at material first, and you look at, you know, in this climate in movies, you look at, you know, how much is nothing. You know, you say you have no money. Does that mean no money?
Everyone says that now.
Or low money, because there's a difference, you know. So you do look at that.
Or does that mean you just have it, but you don't want to part with it?
Or does that mean, I mean, if people ask you, we'd like you to do this movie, but we'd like you to pay us, then you probably don't want to deal with
that. That's not a good proposition.
So you do look at that, you know. And then the same thing. You look at the people involved. You know, you look at material, and then you look at people. Sometimes you look at people first. And if you're that jazzed about the people that are doing the project and you've admired people for a long time and want to collaborate with them, then that signals, you know, your choice.
You seem like the kind of guy to me that could do like a huge blockbuster movie, but then all of a sudden, you know, some kid right out of college would send you a script that you were like, this is really interesting. I'll just come do your movie because it looks neat.
Well, it all winds up in the same place. I mean, you know, you're going to be watching it on your couch, whatever it is, or not. Whatever environment or whatever size of a project doesn't really, you know, it doesn't really necessarily mean anything. It's what's, do you think it's going to work ultimately? You know, it's a guess beforehand, sure. But, you know, over time, you kind of get an instinct of what, you know, what will be successful and what could lead to, you know, a lot of egg on your face.
And how have you made choices before? You're like, I think I've got egg on the face. And then how do you kind of process that? You just go,
well, once you're in, you're in. I mean, that's just part of, that's just part of being professional. You choose to do something, you choose to accept something, you gotta deliver even if it's painful to do so. You know, you try to be as successful within that as I've not been anything where I was just, well, that's not true. But it was for other reasons. I've not been in a situation where I was just continually wincing all the time, going, oh my God, I can't believe I'm doing this. You know, I'm able to, like, you know, block it out or whatever. I was in one situation was I could not believe that it had to do with the inexperience of a crew that had basically never done a movie before, and I didn't realize that. And it was just, we were spending 5 hours on something that should have taken 20 minutes, and it was just you know, that was a little, you know, that was a little rattling, but, you know, I got through that. It was mercifully short, so it didn't matter.
Is there anything other than acting in the business that you would want to do or have done?
I've dabbled in, and I may, you know, at some point before I croak, I've been dabbling, writing a few things that I'd like to, you know, just kind of weird bits and pieces of a character in a story I've got in my head over a long period of time. And maybe, you know, if I ever get over my laziness, I will, you know, put that all together and see if I can. I don't know that I would direct it. I don't know. I think I'd probably be better off with somebody else actually directing it, since I haven't directed anything. But to put some elements together one time would be a goal for me.
Yeah.
You know,
and do you think that have people? I mean, I feel like people must have approached you before. Like, do you want to do this, or have you thought about doing this? And do you kind of go, I'll get to it.
You mean in terms of something other than performing?
Yeah.
A few times, but not a lot. I haven't been approached with, you know, like other, you know, like anything to direct. Not really. You know, it's been most of the time that when there's just, I've got a script. You know, everybody's right. got a script. You know this town, right?
Right.
Everybody's so, good. Just walk into Starbucks, you're going to get five scripts. Doesn't matter where you are.
One of them might be really good.
Right. And they probably are. Right.
So you've been in Los Angeles for 30 years now. You still live here?
Yep. Yeah.
What's your favorite part of L.A.?
Favorite part of L.A.? Well, I don't know. I guess I'd have to, you know, should I say the neighborhood I live in?
No. Don't say the neighborhood you live in. You could just say your neighborhood.
Oh, no. That's not a big deal. I'm just saying, I'm wondering, is that my favorite part of L.A. or not? I'm coming to think. I mean, I like it, but I live in Studio City, but...
That's where all the studios are.
Yeah,
it's
where
a city
all those
of
studios.
The
are.
City of all the studios. Let's connect all these.
Just because you want an answer, I'll say Toluca Lake.
Toluca Lake is nice.
Yeah.
It really came back around in like the last 10
Toluca
10
Lake and Halloween. They do it upright. It's crazy over
It's
there.
Super neighborhoody over there.
Yeah.
In a city that does not have. I don't think of Los Angeles as being neighborhoody. I know there are neighborhoods, but I don't really think of it as like, but that little pocket of Studio City and Toluca Lake, it's like, you know, people come out, kids can run through the streets, there's trees on the streets.
Yeah, no, it's great.
Plenty of parking.
I mean, Bob Hope's from there, come on.
How bad could it be? Lived and died there. He owns a lot of it.
That's right, probably owns all of it.
Took a lot of it from people who were put in internment camps in the 1940s. I heard that was true. I don't know if that's true. I heard that was true. Katie, look it up.
No judgment there. No.
Katie, look it up. That's just what I heard. Yeah. And as Bob Hope is not here to defend himself, we may never know. Bob Hope. Bob Hope. And property, real estate. Bob Hope, real estate. I just had heard that there was a lot of property that was seized during a certain period in America's history, and that some people were able to acquire that property for very low money. Okay, good. Bob Hope, it's not true. Is it okay to say that? Is it okay to say it that way?
You just did.
Okay, good. Doesn't mean it's okay.
Good segue.
Just means I said it.
Yeah.
I love Toluca Lake. There's something about it. Toluca Lake still feels like the area in which, I mean, it still feels like the era in which it cropped up.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we don't have a lot of, you know, it's in a city this large, I feel like LA should have more culture than I feel like it has. There are pockets.
But isn't that the beauty of LA?
LA, what's our identity?
What do you think of when you think of LA? Things it should have but doesn't. Yes. Things, because we're all longing for something.
Yeah. Well, my pal Patton Oswalt has this idea that.
I know Patton.
You know Patton?
Yeah.
Patton has this idea that LA is actually not a beautiful city. He goes, no, whenever people say that, whenever people say LA is a beautiful city, they're looking up at the sky.
Yeah.
They're not looking at the city. They just mean the weather's very nice.
Yeah, or they're wearing their shorts in January. That's what they mean.
It's beautiful. It's a beautiful city. Look, just look up.
It's January 14th, and I got a windbreaker on.
Just look up above all the crap and that litters the streets.
Right.
But in general.
Looks like Blade Runner from the sky.
And you are also in Melissa's movie.
Yes.
Which is that coming out this weekend?
July 2nd.
July 2nd.
Yep.
The big 4th of July movie. Holy shit.
The big one. Well, that's what, she's got the Wednesday before July 4th, yeah.
That's a big one to have.
That's right.
Very impressive, Melissa McCarthy.
That's right. Not everybody gets that spot, goddammit.
I knew Melissa when she went by Missy, and she was a PA on her cousin Jenny McCarthy's sketch comedy show.
Oh, wow, okay.
And I remember at the time thinking, like, but you're really funny. Why are you a PA? And it was just like, well, you got to start somewhere.
Yeah, no, she is... She's on fire. Funny. She's, like I said, she's like Julia. She's lethally funny. And in this movie, yeah, she's she's out of control.
Have you guys had the premiere yet?
No, the premiere is actually, I believe, on Monday the 30th. That's this Monday. Yeah.
Do you like premieres?
Sure. I mean, I don't know anyone that goes like, I can't wait to go to the function and get the photos and the thing. It's gonna be. No, it's fine. It's fun.
I just think they're weird. They still weird me out.
Well, there's just it's a lot of. You know, I think it's the coverage. It's fine. It's great for the business and all that. But it's like a frenzy. It's just like a mini, almost polite frenzy. There's a lot of, you know, a lot of hubbub and a lot of shouting and a lot of, you know, flashing lights and you know, kind of chaos getting into, you know, getting in and out of any of these places. But it's good for the movie. It's a lot of buzz. But once you're in, then it's just watching a movie and then, you know, hanging out at the party and just like it's like anything else. But you know, the carpet phenomenon of where that's gone in the last 20 years is a little surreal. Not that I have all that much knowledge of red carpets. Believe me, my time on them has been limited. But it's you know, you've been on them, sure. I've been on them.
Yeah, they make me really uncomfortable.
Yeah,
I don't feel like I'm ever posing the right way. You feel like you're going to go into a weird seizure
What would be the right way, though? I mean,
I don't know.
Although you see some of these women that are decked, they make definite choices.
I don't think anyone feels comfortable on a red carpet because it's essentially
you can look comfortable and not be comfortable.
Yes,
and then there are those who, you know, do neither.
I think I do neither, but that's fine. It doesn't matter. I don't
either, you know, look comfortable or are comfortable.
I don't do this for red carpets, so it's fine. Like I can be uncomfortable with them.
I think the more you do it, then the less it affects you. That because it's so limited the time I've been on them. Although I've been on them, but it's just, you know, you just you keep waiting for I don't know what to happen. But
isn't it funny to think about the time when the Oscars were like, you know, decades ago? It was just like they just got together like in a hotel conference room. Yeah. And that was it. You know, maybe a couple snapshots, and then they went home.
Yeah, it was no, you know, it wasn't. It didn't get, you know, consumed by the. There was no machine like there is now of this entertainment coverage. It just didn't exist.
Have you been to the Oscars?
No.
I mean,
no.
Feels. I kind of feel like maybe it wouldn't be fun.
No.
It just feels like.
Well, it depends who you were, you know. I mean, I don't know. I guess if you were nominated for two awards, it'd probably be pretty fun. But
I don't know if it would be fun then. Then it would just be stressful.
Well, you just have to. I mean, but it's all so much just kind of, you know, it is just like, you know, what do you think? So, a big evening. I mean, I've literally had that said to me at a red carpet. This was it. So.
You tell me what I should be saying to you.
I'm sorry. So?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, you want me to go from there. Okay.
Yeah, please. I'm scared and I don't know what I'm supposed to ask you.
Right. Literally, it was that. At least it was a word. Sometimes just, you know,
or
just a visual.
Movies?
Yeah, right.
Huh?
Big night?
Huh?
Wow. Big night, huh?
Office space. Ah. They'll just say a thing that they associate you with.
Yeah, you're right.
And then you're supposed to go like, what?
Yes, right.
This
exactly.
Is true.
Yeah.
That is a thing that happened.
Yeah. It's just.
What happened?
And how excited are you supposed to be? That's the other thing.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I mean, how really, literally excited are you supposed to be?
You know, sometimes there are great leaps forward in our nation, the moon landing or. The founding of democracy, and I think this night ranks
right.
You know,
and the 48th SAG Awards, yes, right up there with Neil Armstrong. First step on the lunar landscape. It's equal to me. I am that excited. I could be in a spacesuit right now.
And I have everything figured out.
Yes.
And everything's great.
And then I will. Yes. Oh, and after the awards, oh, the night will just go on forever. And how glorious it will be for all of us.
We all bask in blissful perfection.
Yes.
We're the best people ever.
Somebody said, I've gone 45 minutes without someone telling me how great I am. Oh, my God.
It's weird. It feels weird. Does it feel weird to you? It feels weird to me because I don't. This is a
how
weird
can
gap.
I survive this torment?
I'll tell you, I'm so great. I didn't realize that no one had told me I was great for 45 minutes.
That's right.
That's how humble I am.
You'll get over it.
Well, it was really great to have you on the podcast. Katie just told me that you have to wrap. Are you doing a bunch of press today? Do you have to do press today for the
I've got. Well, I'm on. Yeah, I'm kind of on a bit of a clock. So
you're on the press. Clock.
I'm on the clock carpet, yes.
Well, Gary Cole, please take your blissful perfection out into the world and continue to do wonderful things.
Yes, I shall.
That please our brains greatly.
I shall go out among the great unwashed and see
Oh, how brave.
How I will survive.
How brave.
How brave of me.
Don't let them get any of their gnats
on you. No, but enough about me. What about you? What do you think about me?
Well, I can't stop thinking about how wonderful it is for you to be talking to me right now.
Well,
I mean for
same.
You, of course.
Thank you. Thank
We're
you.
Really doing Hollywood right.
How good for us.
And for you, who get to witness the 2014 tour of Colin Hardwick's Blissful Perfection.
Yes.
Now
called, it's called We Just Reek of Privilege. Thank you.
Whoever thought you could actually listen to gold? But here it is, pouring into your ears in yellow fountains. How lucky for you.
Liquid audio gold.
Double stuff, even. As we take you back into your lives, your pathetic lives. When you remember that, yes, you are beneath us, but how lucky are you to carry us like Xerxes across the desert of your lives, which are quite drab in comparison to ours. Gary is wearing very expensive cargo shorts at the moment.
Yes. They are a nice maroon, though.
A maroon which you could not afford with the pittance that you bring home.
Oh.
That was a good place to end.
There you go.
Enjoy your burrito, everyone.
Thanks.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
Nancy's love story could have been ripped right out of the pages of one of her own novels.
She was a romance mystery writer who happens to be married to a chef.
But this story didn't end with a happily ever after.
When I stepped into the kitchen, I could see that Chef Brophy was on the ground, and I heard somebody say, call 911.
As writers, we'd written our share of murder mysteries. So when suspicion turned to Dan's wife, Nancy, we weren't that surprised.
The first person they look at would be the spouse.
We understand that's usually the way they do it.
But we began to wonder, had Nancy gotten so wrapped up in her own novels?
There are murders in all of the books.
That she was playing them out in real life? You can listen to Happily Never After, Dan and Nancy, early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.